This is a Pinball News production.
To get started with this idea of a pinball as art, so it kind of helps to have a framework if you're going to think of yourself as an artist. And a lot of people consider sort of aesthetic, even though it's not really well defined, aesthetic is sort of being like a quality of art. So that's what you're striving for. And what I found, you know, the definition that I like for aesthetic is that it's content put into an overall structure to create meaning. And this actually makes it kind of easy for us because once we have the structure, we can apply it to pinball, and it makes it pretty simple to apply this to pinball because content is all of the mechanisms that we actually put into the game, all the things we're familiar with, the flippers, the thumpers, drop targets, things like that. So that's simple. The structure, again, fairly straightforward. The structure is just how you lay out your game, right? How many thumpers you use, how many drop targets you use, flippers and the like. And then meaning is the more difficult part because, you know, most people think of art as being sort of a form of communication. So music, film, photography, they're all sort of alternate ways of communicating. And so if pinball is art, then you sort of have to have something to say. You have to kind of decide what it is you want to say with your artwork. And so coming up with, you know, the meaning that you want to communicate is sometimes the tricky part. But what I like to do and what I've done for my work is that what I like to do is, to create the aesthetic, what I like to do is think of a challenge and try to turn that into your aesthetic. So in a lot of ways, I think that what you can do is you walk up to a pinball machine and you may like the layout or something, but you might think there's a flaw. You might think to yourself in your head, you know, hey, I could do this better than the way it was done, or I don't like the way this game plays, or whatever, and turn that into your challenge that then becomes your aesthetic. Then you can say, what I want to do is I want to show that this pinball machine could have been made in a way that it plays much better, or something else, or I could show that you could play a game with only using one flipper, you know, and that becomes your aesthetic. You know, think of a challenge, and you can do this based on you know, games that you see, you know, when you go out and you look at the games, you get inspired by these games, and sometimes it doesn't even have to be games that you like. Sometimes it can be games that you don't like. You walk up to a game that you really hate, and you think, wow, I could have done, you know, this and that. It would have been much better, and then, you know, just go and execute that. So back to the, sorry to go backwards here, but, so back to, you know, the content, structure, and meaning. So if we think of content as being sort of words, structure is sort of the grammar, then the meaning sort of becomes the syntax and it's part of our language. So as artists, you know, we always want to innovate. So innovating in a way is like creating new words for this language. And one of the things that you know, John Papaduck had a seminar a couple hours ago, some of you might have been in there, but he was talking about how when you walk up to a pinball machine, you sort of expect it to look a certain way. Like, you can't just change the size of the ball and expect people to not think that it's weird. You can't change the width of it. You know, you can't put the flippers, or you can't do like one flipper and think that have people think that's not weird, or you can't put you know, like 10 thumpers, you know, in the play field. So there's certain things that people expect. And so when you innovate, it's like creating new words, and you want people to understand, but so that means you kind of have to fit within a certain structure and at the same time introduce new innovative features to try and expand people's language and understanding of the pinball. So my first game that I built, I have sort of formulated a couple of challenges that sort of defined what I thought my aesthetic was going to be and what I was trying to communicate. So this being the first game, and you might have seen it, it's out in the hallway there. Hopefully we had a chance to play it. So obviously the first game was really a way to sort of break the ice and show people that a custom pinball game could be made. That's sort of like the number one aesthetic. And I tried to do it sort of in an 80s style. Now, I kind of skipped past it, but this montage here of play fields that you were seeing, these are about 200 different play fields that I had studied for the purpose of trying to create an 80s looking game. So when you look at this game here, so the idea is to make it sort of a very 80s style game, which is kind of street level, not a lot of ramps, not a lot of wire forms. But at the same time, I wanted to do something innovative, kind of create like a magic kind of feature. And so one of the things I've done here is I actually have this thumper in the middle here. It's actually a negative scoring thumper. So that's something that you would never see or even be able to do with an 80s game, because they just didn't do that. Electronics just were not set up for it. Even the scoring's not set up for it. So when you start playing this game, you might think it's from the 80s, but then once you realize the thing goes negative, that's kind of impossible in an 80s game. So it's sort of that's like the magic feature. That's what I'm calling the innovation feature. I'm also tried to a lot of 80s games, they don't play as nicely as the newer games. You see, newer games these days, they have lots of levels, lots of different shots you can do. There's a lot more going on, whereas an 80s style game usually has, you just hit a bunch of targets, and targets reset, and then you just hit them again. So what I try to do with this game is give it a little bit more of a sort of game theory, kind of a risk and reward kind of thing, so that when you try to go for certain shots and you miss, that's when the thing goes negative. And then in order to go to reset it back to positive, then that resets your drop targets, and you keep going back and forth, and you have to sort of make choices about how risky a shot is versus what the reward is going to be. So I feel that once you play the game, you can play the game for maybe 50 or 100 games and then realize that your strategy, you can shift your strategy and do something completely different. And then now you've got sort of a whole new mode of gameplay. And at any time, please ask questions about anything, because this is going to be kind of free form.
So is this like a completely original design just based off of your studies of other play fields for that field?
Yes.
You didn't start with something and just modify it?
Right, exactly. So I studied a ton of games and sort of picked out the ones that I liked and the features that I liked about the different games. But this game itself basically started as a blank piece of wood, drilled all the holes, put in the lenses, did all the artwork from scratch. Used a lot of vintage mechanisms, so it kind of looks 80s. But it is... a completely ground up from scratch pinball. And it's a good point because, in terms of the design, looking at designs, because, and what I'm showing here in this montage is that I'm actually showing a montage of like three or four different play fields that I specifically studied. And then sort of for my first one, it wasn't very sophisticated. I was basically printing out like all kinds of different CAD drawings, and basically just cutting and pasting them in places on a sheet of paper, and then scanning that in, and then putting that into a CAD system. So it was very much like deconstructing a bunch of different play fields, and literally cutting and pasting elements that I liked and rearranging them and organizing them sort of in a very low-tech method, just on a sheet of paper. Later, what I did, and I'll get into it more, is there are a lot of tools out there, kind of sophisticated but still accessible tools, where you can design and test your play field before you actually build it. In fact, this right here is a computer simulation of the game that was done shortly, sort of in conjunction, that helped to test the physics and the game rules and stuff like that.
That's how Ted Zale of Bally back in the 50s and 60s used to design stuff. He'd have a set of playfield pieces and he just rearrange them on a big sheet of paper, and that was a good game.
Yeah, exactly. So
fast way to do it.
And it is, and when I'm, I have a blog where I talk about all the different, how to build a pinball machine and all this stuff, and I like to present two or three different methods so that people can kind of pick the method that matches their skill set and what the tools I have available. And obviously the easiest thing is to simply print out a bunch of stuff you like, cut out pieces and paste it together. But as you get more sophisticated, and I think the new paradigm actually is going to be that people design on the computer first, all the physics, as well as you can overlay the artwork, see how the artwork fits in with the game, and then maybe you do two or three simulations, and then you can actually decide, well, which game do I really want to invest in building before, so you can build two or three, and then say, well, this is the one that I'm playing all the time on the computer, so this is the one that I'm going to go ahead and build. let's see. So, I kind of mentioned this before, or just in the process, but so a lot of the things that are on the playfield are sort of generic to 80s games. So you have, top lanes, stand-up targets and spinners, drop targets, and out lanes. So it's all very, the basic framework of it is very, it's kind of standard to an 80s game. And even some specific things, I really like the inline drop targets from Harlem Globetrotters and Black Pyramid. So I kind of included this as sort of a main feature. The difference is that when you get it, if you get it into this top ball lock, you get an extra ball. And I also like from Skateball and some other games, Flash, this skill shot on the ball launch where you go over and across, also to lock that. And this also brings up another thing about designing pinball machines today is that 80s games, a lot of them had shoot lanes where, like, there were dedicated shoot lanes, and then the rest of the play field sort of took up the other, 18 inches of the play field. So in modern games, you really want to make use of every single inch of play field area that you have. So I'm always looking for ways to launch the ball into the playfield that sort of leaves extra space to do other things. Because in the 70s and 80s, this is all dead space here on the side. And instead of going, a lot of people go wide body, but I think that it's better to try to keep it standard size and just sort of try and be innovative in how you launch the ball into the playfield. So one of the other things I was mentioning earlier too, is sort of it's a risk and reward. So like to get the extra ball, you got to hit these in lines. But if you just miss by just an inch, you end up hitting this target that turns it negative. And then if you decide, well, I want to flip it back to positive, so I got to go through this turnaround, but then that resets your drop targets. So you may end up going back and forth between trying to hit the drop targets, and then now I got to reset them and. So it's a little bit of a risk and reward, but at the same time, it sort of changes your approach to how you play the game because, for instance, on your first ball, you get most of your points on collecting the bonus. So if the thing goes negative, you might decide, well, I'm just going to keep playing because of 0 points, and then collect a bonus at the end, and I don't care. On the last ball, you might say, well, I've scored a whole bunch of points. I'll just let the ball drain, and I'm guaranteed to get, you know, at least the score that I had. So, like, how many games would you intentionally let the ball drain in order to get more points? So, it's and that way, I think it's a little bit of game theory involved. Any questions about sort of the fabrication or anything about other games so far?
I'll bring up one question.
Yeah.
So when you have this entrance shot crossing the play field and trying to engage with a ramp to curve around the top and then go into top lane or whatever up top, it seems like you have to be designing for very exact pitch. Like it's more sensitive to the pitch of the game when you have something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say yes and no, because I've seen it both ways. So what happens is that when you change the pitch of the machine, that will happen, but you also, it only takes a very minor tweak of the rail to get it to aim where you want it. In fact, it's more, that kind of shot is actually more dependent on sort of your exit angle coming off that wall than it is on the actual angle of the play field. So a lot of times I'll start with like a preset angle that I like and then just tweak the rails slightly to get the angle correct. But that is a good point. And when you design this in simulation is actually really accurate, and so you can actually set those angles and it'll pretty realistically tell you if you're gonna make that shot or if you're not gonna make that shot. And some of you have seen Retro Spa, so it's pretty obvious it's sort of a takeoff on Future Spa. If you played Future Spa, you know this, it's a wide body game. I myself, I love the artwork. Dave Christensen did some really great artwork on that. But at the same time, it doesn't really play very well, so they didn't make great use of the wide body format. They kind of just did it just for the sake of whatever sales or whatever. So the aesthetic behind this sort of is what I'm trying to show is that game, that Future Spa game, could have been redesigned or re-engineered as a standard size game without the necessity to use all this extra space. So that was just sort of one idea I had. The other thing was I found some sketches that Dave Christensen had done that were sort of the original concepts that ended up getting rejected, and then he had to sort of start over. So we ended up getting some great artwork, but he actually, that was not his original idea. So kind of what I did was I sort of fleshed out what I thought he was going for with the, you notice he uses a lot of these Greek helmets. I kind of changed the figures, and there wasn't a lot of detail in his sketches, so I just sort of had to guess at a lot of the stuff he was doing. Same for the back glass. But the idea was to try and just sort of try and reimagine what Future Spa would have been if they had gone in a different direction, kind of an alternate history version of Future Spa. And the same thing about trying to get the ball into the play field is that you notice I put the shooters on the left-hand side. So on Future Spa, there's like four lanes over here, which is kind of a waste. You just have like four different lanes. But so I actually turned the shooter lane into the entrance lane, and it sort of doubles as the kickback lane. Any questions or anything about the fabrication or this game?
Yeah, Brian. Do you produce these regularly, or just as you feel like it, or do you sell them, or how?
Well, I don't. Up to now, I don't sell them. But what I've done, my process up till now has been, I'll start one, and I'll get to a certain level. About 6 months later, I'll start another one, and so I might have two or three games actually in process at any time. But the whole process takes about maybe a year and a half.
And these are never like where you take someone's physical game and just repaint. These are from scratch.
Yeah, these are all
cabinet
from
even.
Two out of the three have brand new cabinets. But one of them is like an old copy.
Are they all solid state?
The ones I build are solid state. I do all the electronics myself.
What for an MPU?
I use an Arduino for the MPU. And I use Arduino. You're going to see in the exhibit hall, the expo hall, there's going to be a lot of guys there with brand new equipment, electronics, specifically designed for making custom games. I kind of made a conscious decision to use the Arduino because that actually has the lowest barrier to entry. It's more accessible to people that are just starting out. So you know, Arduinos were developed basically for teaching high school students about microcontroller electronics. So there's tons of them out there. You can buy it at Radio Shack. You can download the programming stuff you need off the internet, and there's just all kinds of forums on how to use Arduinos. So it may not be like the sort of, you know, high-end, best, absolute, you know, best controller that you could use for a pinball machine, especially if you're going to do like a production game. But it definitely is the lowest barrier to entry. If you're talking about doing a one-off game, you're doing the whole thing yourself, so you basically have to you know, decide what skills are sort of in your wheelhouse and which ones are not. But having using tools and things like that are sort of have easy access, I made a conscious effort to do it in that way.
Do you silk screen or
I do. I would prefer to do silk screen, but I actually don't. What I do is I print. I have a couple different techniques I've tried, but the best one is printing on vinyl, which you can have done. Almost any sign shop can do a print on vinyl. And I usually give them like a sheet of Mylar that you can buy at like Marco Specialty that's meant for playfield protection. And they will roll-to-roll laminate that on top of the vinyl. And then you can apply the whole thing as one sheet. I looked into screen printing, and to get it would cost maybe $200 per screen just to have the one screen made. Mm-hmm. And if you're talking about like a 6 or 7 color spot color process, you could easily get the cost of a pinball machine just to do this screen.
I think what you're doing shows great initiative. And I know you said that Retro Spa, you were trying to show that Future Spa could be made narrow. And you talked about having a message, so I'm trying to piece it together in my mind. You're an artist then, and a physical artist. Do you, besides having them at the show, do you have like a museum? Do you have them on show for the public? Who's receiving your message?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, you guys right here in the audience are receiving the message.
Right now. But right, I mean, between expos.
I don't put them on display, except I actually do. I have taken them to the Seattle Pinball Museum.
Okay.
A couple of times, and I'm actually very I'm new to this part of it myself, even though I've been doing pinball for a long time. So my audience mainly up till now has sort of been on the internet, because I have a blog. It's like a how to build a pinball machine blog where I don't really take this sort of philosophical approach. I take a more detailed, hands-on approach where, like, this is the type of drill you use to drill this, and this is the process to put a lens in, and this is the type of wood you use and all that. So my audience is intended to be more global, internet-based audience of people that want to
do what you're doing.
Right. Yeah, and these are sort of the examples of what can be done. But there isn't, I don't have people coming over, you know, that just come to the, want to see, you know, the pinball machines as art.
How many have you done?
Well, I'm on number 3, and I've got a fourth one that I'm working on at home right now. So there's 3 out there. One's a whitewood, and there's a fourth one, and then I have a fifth one in simulation, computer simulation.
Pretty cool.
But yeah, so and as you pointed out, you know, this is sort of pinball as art, and I feel that, and also back to the printing question, that if you're going to do, if it's going to be an art piece, printing on vinyl is actually a much more cost-effective solution for a one-off thing. And you can get almost as good quality results, because when people first look at it, a lot of people actually think that it's screen printed.
Yeah,
you have to actually look really closely, you know, see tiny bubbles, and it probably could have been done even better if I'd done a couple more iterations to get the process right. So, and that printing the vinyl cost less than $100 combined, and if I had done three or four, they could have been down to like $50 a piece for a print, and you'd easily spend, you know, 10 times that for trying to screen print something. Even though I prefer screen printing, you know, as a production process. Yeah, so basically, these are just some details about how the different things that had to be changed to convert it to standard body. Basically, everything had to be relaid out. Obviously, fewer lanes in the top, fewer lanes on the bottom, no lanes on the sides. Had to kind of rearrange the thumpers here, but the idea was that. And I looked at the rules of the game for Future Spa, and then sort of programmed the Arduino to do almost exactly what Future Spa does, but using the reduced number of lanes that we have here. So when you play the game, if you play Future Spa, you'll know exactly how to play Future Spa. It plays almost exactly the same. So the other game that's out there, it's been giving me some trouble, but hopefully everyone will get a chance to try it out. But I kind of we're trying to take it up a notch with my third game, but at the same time keep the 80s feel. And so I did sort of a two-level game, but a lot like Black Knight or Jungle Lord. So it doesn't use alpha rams or wire rams, it uses sort of the old school stainless steel rams. So a couple of things that, you know, in trying to sort of expand the aesthetic and take it up a notch with this game, one of the things I wanted to do is I was kind of inspired by the Multimorphic guys, where they have this. They have this LCD play field, and they have an interchangeable upper play field that is the mechanical section. I think it's innovative, but it's also, it kind of takes you a little bit farther away from pinball than I like, but I like where they're going with that. So what I wanted to do was actually do something similar, where the upper play field, you imagine like a Black Knight or a Jungle Lord, but imagine you were able to take that play field out, put in a different upper play field, and then you essentially have a whole different game. Or if you built two games that each had a lower and an upper play field that were interchangeable, then you swap them out, and now you have four different combinations of games, essentially, for the cost of two. And then just kind of, you know, can go on and on like that. Like on the other games, I like to add sort of like a magic element to the game. And so in this game, it's not really completely obvious, but what happens is there's a ball lock here, and when this ball gets locked, there's actually a third virtual play field that's underneath. And what will happen is you'll lock the ball, it'll virtually drop to this lower play field. You'll play that game. When that drains, you go back out. And then the next time, the game actually changes to something different. And so every time you lock the ball and go to this virtual play field, you're playing a different game. And so like a lot of the games we have now with the sort of idea of levels, you know, you can do the sort of similar thing with an 80s style game, because games like Electra and Black Hole obviously have lower levels. But you can actually make it, keep it fresh and change up the game during the play, basically. again, at any time, just to get any questions, just let me know. But so as I said, so it's a multi-level style game, but with but kept in sort of an 80s style, sort of a magic feature that kind of hooks people into it, and then a modular design, kind of helps to keep the game fresh. Like if you decide that a lot of people, they play a game for, especially an 80s style game, that the thrill of the game doesn't really last as long as some of the newer games. But this is a way that you can actually, if you built two or three of them, you could sort of almost interchange at will to create new games. It's going to be an LCD, and I actually have two or three of the virtual games already designed and ready to go. I just don't have the LCD installed, but I sort of have tested it sort of in a mock-up sense, and I communicate back and forth using there are things called LED Wiz. It's made for virtual pen, and you're able to sort of send keystrokes and also get back signals out of it. So I kind of use that to communicate back and forth. I also use sort of a retro feature here with a thumper in the middle and two flippers on the outside. It's something that people haven't seen in a while. This center loop shot with the array of lights here sort of modeled off of Silver Ball Mania, which if people recognize that, they kind of get a feel for what the object of the game is, which is basically, hit as many targets as you can to light that up. This is this game's not here, but this is the fourth game that I'm designing.
What's it called?
This one's called Tattoo Mystique. this one I actually had a local artist, local to Seattle, do the tattoo sort of artwork on the play field. Both because that's sort of outside of my, my style, sort of outside of my style, but also it kind of sort of helps speed up the process of building the games, because I was working on the Misadventure while the artist I had was working on this playfield here. Again, this is sort of like a standard 80s game, but what I'm doing here that I'm trying to make it a little bit different is that I'm going to have actually two different colored balls that get interchanged when it goes through this upper loop. And when the ball is, I have one that's black and one that's brass colored. When the ball is colored black, you play the game one way, and you try and hit certain targets. And when the ball turns brass colored, now the game changes, you got to hit a different set of targets. And the thing becomes sort of like a puzzle, because you have to. Well, you don't have to. It'll tell you, but you can't. The targets that you hit when you're playing with the black ball, now if you switch to the brass ball, if you hit it, it unlights it, and then you got to start over again. What you call the aesthetic that I'm driving for here is what I wanted to create a game that someone who was an expert pinball player would walk up to it, and if they understood the game, there's a good chance that they might actually not score any points. Because what happens is the more targets you hit, your bonus gets higher and higher, and there's sort of a risk and reward that a really good player is going to try and hit all of the targets before collecting the bonus, whereas a more amateur player or someone didn't know the game might walk up, start hitting stuff, collect a bonus, hit some more stuff, collect a bonus, and they might build up a moderate score, whereas a really great player might walk up to it, try to go for the whole thing, and then end up with no points. So I'm trying to sort of invert this idea that the high score or the people that are really good at the game may not actually get the high score. It's sort of a little bit of game theory there. But again, done in sort of a very 80s style. There's white wood in that. Yeah. So I would say that each machine probably takes a year and a half to 2 years from start to finish, but I have multiple games going at the same time, either in just in layout or in fabrication or doing the artwork. So I'll start one, about 6 months later I might start another one or work out some ideas. So I've been cranking them out about every 6 months, but the whole process can take as much as 2 years. And of course, you know, everybody has a real job, and this is all spare, you know, doing stuff in your spare time, so it does take quite a bit. And so basically I think there's three steps, and I think we covered the first two, is that you need understanding the language of pinball requires you to kind of study the history of pinball, building your aesthetic, and what you're trying to say is sort of the second step, and the third step is the technology. So there are a couple things about the technology and where we're at today that sort of really make it the opportune time for people to get into building their own custom pinball machine. One of them is that we have this sort of rising interest, or general rising interest in pinball. The other is that there's sort of a cultural phenomenon of what they call the maker movement. So the technology and with this maker movement is, as opposed to like hacking, where you take existing electronics and hack it apart and rework it to do things. The maker movement is more about actually, instead of using old stuff, actually make stuff from scratch. So there's a lot of like 3D printing has really gone crazy. The other tools that are good for this, CNC routing, laser cutting, and there's a lot of support around this maker movement. So those two things coming together, the interest in pinball, so restoration of pinball has provided lots of reproduction parts, whereas 10 years ago, you know, it'd be hard to find like a flipper assembly. You know, you have to scavenge it out of an old machine. Now you can buy flipper assemblies, bumper assemblies, drop targets. You know, you can buy them reproduction. So those two things together sort of make it, kind of creating a watershed for custom pinball. So, the first part of the technology, I think, is the simulation. I kind of mentioned this earlier, but there's a program called Visual Pinball that is it's not only a it's not just a game platform, but it actually is a design tool because you not only play the games, but you can actually go in, you can modify games, you can start from scratch, you can build your own games, and this is downloadable for free, as well as downloading all of the, you know, almost 500 different tables. A lot of the more advanced table authors have provided templates that allow people to get started. I use templates myself, and I actually put my full games back on the site so people can download those for templates. But I really think this is sort of going to be, in my mind, the new paradigm of how pinball in general is done, is that you simulate first, work out the kinks, work out the physics, and then make the decision on whether you really want to build it or not before you even start cutting any wood.
Those magnets in the upper level?
These are spinners.
The spinners, okay. Yeah. Set up all the running holders. So.
Yeah, so it could, yeah, in theory it could be magnets as well. This is meant to be, I'm calling this one, this is going to be sort of a roller derby themed pinball. So these are going to be sort of like spinning wheels, like a roller skate. You also notice that it matches the Misadventure layout, so that, so even though the layout is different on the top and bottom, I could, in theory, interchange this top with the other bottom, or the bottom with the other top, and I'd have two new games.
How well do you find the virtual translates? Like, I mean, I think we've all probably played virtual pinball. And played,
yeah.
The physics are,
yeah,
not like the physics of the world I know in pinball.
Yeah. I've heard some people complain about it, but I actually found, you know, when I did it virtually and then I played the game, I found it to be pretty accurate.
Okay.
So the things that I designed here, I was making the same shots and not making the same shots.
So you felt like it worked?
I felt like it was pretty good.
Like you didn't have to spend tons of time tweaking and stuff like that?
No. Well, you're always tweaking something, but in terms of how the ball works, how the shots work, the width and spacing of your lanes and stuff like that, all of that translated really well. But I know some people have had some complaints, but I thought the physics were great on these games. And then the other thing about this is that you, by downloading games, you actually study sort of the history of pinball and how what's been done before. You can sort of paste and cut and paste elements from different games and to use in your own game. And then at the very end, you can actually export not a DXF, but you can actually export something that you can take into Illustrator and then use that as a template for your CAD work.
Does that mean the 3D rendering also, the application?
It won't export 3D, which is a shame. It only exports in 2D. So it's not like it's not a true 3D program, but obviously what you're seeing here are 3D elements. But what it exports is two-dimensional, or 2.5D, sort of.
The simulation, though, is it in terms of emulating a third dimension, does it just like change the physics as the ball is rolling over the ramps to kind of slow it down, or does it?
No, it actually has 3D physics. So in some of these, you can see the ball being shot up the ramp, and actually you can kind of tell it actually lifts up in the air. It's going up in the air and then landing.
Yeah.
So it's doing the 3D portion of it pretty well.
XYZ coordinates.
Yeah, yeah. And they're making improvements all the time. So this is sort of, it's not open source, but it's open source in the sense that it's being supported, community supported, and people submit code to it. And so it gets updated constantly. So even in the time that I've used it, the versions have improved dramatically from 3 years ago to now. So I highly recommend, as a starting point, even if you don't plan on doing a whole virtual simulation, it's a good starting point because you can actually look at games, you can decide what you like, you can print stuff out and cut and paste different elements if you like. It's just a really great starting point.
Do you author the game block?
Yes, and so what I think the virtual game does well too is that it helps you work out the game rules. So things that you thought were going to be really fun may end up being terrible, and you might. So it's really good to sort of exercise the game rules as well. If you're not really sure, a lot of times you'll do a layout and you might think a shot's going to be really hard, but it turns out to be really easy. And so you might say to change the game rules up to make it you have to alternate shots or something like that.
Do you get any code reuse, or do you just completely recode it once you get to the article?
I do recode it, yeah, but it does help to have the structure in place. So you know what the variables are going to be, and you kind of have a sense of what the algorithms are going to be to do the coding. But it doesn't port directly.
Sort of defined
yeah, but it doesn't port directly to other programming. It would be nice, and I think some of the guys out here in the expo, they may actually have, I think especially Multimorphic, may have an interface.
Yeah,
at least
for the Pinball guys with Multimorphic, it seems like it would be perfect for them to just say, here's a thing.
Yeah.
You can write the code the same way you're going to use it in Star Box or whatever.
And I know that they do that with PinMame, which is basically the ROM emulation, but I don't know if they extended it to the actual visual pinball code. But those guys, there are people that are actually doing that sort of higher level thing, so if you decided that you really wanted it to be, to take it to that level, like if that's your strength, then there are definitely guys out there doing it. And so in terms of this whole idea of the maker movement and why now's a great time. So there's all these sort of maker spaces and hacker spaces all over the country now. And I know in Seattle there's at least 3 or 4, and one in Tacoma that I really like. And these are, you know, wherever you're located, your chances are there's going to be a makerspace community where you're at. And just as an example, this is the one in Tacoma. So just a little clip, screenshot from their catalog. They have a class on basic Arduino. They have a class on CNC routing, and then another class right below it on laser cutting.
Are you talking about that, like retail space, like a store?
Well, that's a good question, because they kind of organize it differently. Each one is sort of an individual. It's not like a McDonald's where they're the same everywhere. Yeah. But in general, they are the same in the sense that it's sort of community-based, in the sense that a group of people come together and decide they want to do it, and they'll either rent a space, and it might be a nonprofit, or they might decide that they're going to... it'll be a couple guys, and they'll charge per hour to come in, or it could be that they have a class and you take the class. But in general, the way most of them work is that you become a member, you train on using the equipment, and then you're allowed to use the equipment. And so for something like building a playfield, you know, having access to a CNC router is like ideal. I did all of my playfields by hand with a hand drill, Forstner bits, and put the lenses in. But if you could do it, you know, with a CNC router, you basically have like 90% of your handwork is going to be taken care of. So just as an example of how sort of this phenomenon of the maker community is helping us out. And on top of this, almost all of these places, they love the 3D printers. So if you like doing the sculpting or doing little toys for your playfield, you know, 3D printers are definitely the way to go. And then just as an example, you know, I don't know if anybody's in local to Chicago, but there's a quick search on the internet, there's like at least 3 makerspaces right here in Chicago.
How do you search on it? Just maker movement in quotes or something?
Usually you can search hackerspace or makerspace, and just those keywords, and usually a wiki will come up with locations, or all of the locations, and you can search by city, whichever you're local to. Most major cities, like I said, Seattle has like 3 or 4, Chicago has at least 3. You know, I can't vouch for these, and so each makerspace has its own personality, and so you may or may not find ones that you like, or you may find one and have to...
Brian, are makerspaces or hackerspaces, are they only for pinball, or is it for anything else?
It's like a huge phenomenon.
Community workshops.
Yeah. For anything.
There's a lot of the digital, the Arduino, and a lot of like octocopters and all that stuff.
What
like
are other examples of what people would make in that?
A lot of 3D printing. So you got people in there doing a lot of different weird things. Making 3D printing to make 3D printing.
Yeah,
so whatever they want.
Yeah. So whatever
they want.
People like
you want a hand, molded hand, you go 3D print yourself molded hand, and it's all about like the open source programming to do all that stuff. So a lot of them have wood shops attached, so you got the people that are just doing the wood shop stuff, you got the people that are into the octocopters and the rockets and the, you know,
a lot of networking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Someone made it go out.
So they all vary.
Yeah, it's on the news, yeah.
They all vary based on location as to what that community is kind of.
It's like a little community college. For 3D printing?
Imagine like a community college where you had basically guys that all wanted to do the same thing. They're all experts in this do-it-yourself stuff, and they all got together and they created their own space.
Yeah.
That's kind of what it's like.
What's the term? I'm not from a rural area, but in farming communities where it's a collective.
Collective, right?
Yeah.
There you go. And so, and some of these guys are into pinball, but it's not, it just so happens like the guy in Tacoma is into pinball, but in reality what we're doing is we're leveraging this existing community of people that are already doing all kinds of different stuff, and we're just, you'd be leveraging their equipment and their knowledge and a lot of their classes and things like that, so... again, is sort of this two phenomena coming together, pinball and the maker phenomenon. And then as artists, we're taking advantage of all of that together.
So while there may be three of them in Seattle, that doesn't mean there's three, they're all doing pinball. You might be the only one.
Yeah, you could be the only one doing pinball.
They just provide the tools and all the equipment, and you just go in and do whatever it is.
Do whatever you want.
Okay. Sometimes they charge by the hour. Sometimes you become a member, and you get access.
I get it.
It works different ways. And some of them, not typically, but sometimes they will actually... you pay them to do a run for you, but that's usually not typical. Usually they expect you to come in and learn and then use the equipment.
See, when you said the maker movement spread across the country, I had a perception that it was 100% pinball. I thought, wow, really? All these people across the country making pinball?
Yeah.
I better plug into that.
We're just taking advantage of it.
On the idea of art, I mean, art is very, very subjective in terms of what is art, what's not art. Obviously, in manufactured or production of pinball, there's a large art component to that. You don't hire artists to do certain parts of it, but it's a team-based approach. So how did you arrive and say, I'm not just building a one-off pinball machine, I am making art?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So you kind of have to make a distinction, because pinball obviously has artwork on it, right? And there are a lot of famous artists that are pinball artists. And the old paradigm was sort of that you had a whole big team of people. The artists, the guys that actually drew the artwork, had their, dedicated to that. You had people dedicated to the layout, people dedicated to electronics. So what I'm sort of pitching as an approach is that the pinball machine, the entire machine, is actually one unified work of art. In fact, not just the cabinet and the play field and all the artwork, but when you walk up to it and you start looking at the play field, you look at all the mechanisms of where they are, you start to play it, and the machine is sort of talking to you in a way, is telling you what the targets it wants you to hit. It rewards you with a score. It becomes sort of an interactive experience. It's a little bit of a light show, it's a little bit of a sound show. So what I'm trying to pitch here is that the entire machine is one work of art, right? And so as a pinball artist, you're kind of responsible for the whole thing yourself. Now, that would have been impossible like 20 years ago. I mean, they needed to have a whole team of people. The difference between that and a production machine is that a production machine, just by the fact you have so many people on it, there's going to be all kinds of compromises in the art, right? Whether it's like time crunches, like Dave Christensen, I mean, I can imagine that he's probably got managers over his shoulder saying, you got to get it done faster. And, imagine what he would have done if they'd given him as much time as he wanted, right? Or Steve Ritchie, if they gave him, they let him use like 10 magnets on a game instead of having the bean counters come say, well, we need to knock this down to two magnets and, you got to lose three other features. Right. So, and then the other side of that too is the production machine has to, your audience. Production machine has to have as big an audience as possible. So you're always making artistic compromises in order to get broad appeal. Right. As a pinball artist, you could make a pinball machine that basically is just, maybe it's just for you and your friends. Right. And it has everything that you wanted on it, right? That you and your friends want. Maybe you're the only people that actually understand what the machine's about, right? But that machine, done by yourself, and it has everything you want, and that machine is going to be sort of priceless to you. Whereas, a production pinball machine, there's a ceiling to how much value it has, right? They might get, if they're lucky, they might get like $8,000, and that price goes down as it gets older. Whereas an art machine, basically, there's a lot of people I know that, if they had an art machine, they probably would never sell it. It'd become, invaluable to them. So, So that was a good question. That's basically what I'm pitching is the difference between, you know, pinball as art and production.
Well, plus they're
I have a question on a totally different topic.
Well,
okay. All I was saying is, plus they need to make a profit, we don't.
Right. Yeah, exactly. They're worried about the bottom line.
Yeah.
They have to appeal to as many people as possible, so they make compromises, they add all the things that people like, even if you don't, it's going to be in there.
You didn't do sound design on any of your machines. Is that because it's hard or because you don't like it?
Well, that's a good question because I actually get that. I've gotten that question more than once.
That's the next
about the sound design.
So
the one thing is that, so personally, I like the old school chimes, right? So all of my games are actually designed, the wiring is there to put the chimes in. And in one game, I actually realized that they were unplugged, so I plugged it in. So the chimes are now on.
So it'll make noise now.
But it's very, it's still a very retro sound. So as my aesthetics is evolving, I think that I might be, right now I'm kind of stuck in the 80s. Maybe I'll move up into the late 80s and I'll start doing electronic sound.
With this electronic sound.
But yeah, I can say though that if I were to, a lot of people ask me, am I going to do like a production machine or am I going to mass produce it? But I have a feeling that if I were going to do something like that, then yeah, you definitely have to address all those things. Like the sound design would be more important, lighting. There are a lot of great examples out there that I look at and I'm like, wow, like this is really what I'd like to be building. But at the same time, it kind of has to fit into your own personal aesthetic.
You're building the physical one, do you put, like, I don't know, let's just say it was a slingshots or something, you know, call the triangle, slingshots.
Yeah, slingshots, yeah.
Like, do you make it so that maybe one of them is a fixed point and two of the other are slots so that you can
conservative, liberal,
that type of
thing? You mean just for testing?
Well,
or for, like,
it's a, it's,
on the fly?
It's a one-off piece. But
yeah.
But still, once you're making what worked on the computer into something physical, it may not be responding, and you're like, gosh, I wish I could.
Yeah.
Whereas there's one that is, if you're one fixed point and two variable points with slots or something, you could adjust everything almost. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of stuff.
Yeah, there are a lot of techniques, like sort of like a pegboard technique, where people have mentioned this to me before. Like if you just had like a lot of holes everywhere, and you can move the posts around, you know, do that kind of thing. I like what you're saying. You're saying if you, just for tweaking, if you could just take the slingshot and just sort of angle it in different ways and see what gets the best physics. I do a lot of that in the simulation. I find that the simulation is pretty accurate to the reality. I like your idea. Like if you were to do it, I'd like to see that maybe on a game on the fly. Like maybe the game changes. That could be your innovation. You know, have the slingshot changes angle. And you get good shots. Yeah, the more points you get, the better it makes the slingshot. Maybe the more challenging it makes the slingshot.
Can you briefly go over what you provide on your websites and blogs and stuff as far as what you get?
Yeah, and a lot of this stuff, the rest of this I kind of talked about before. Basically, you know, there's a cottage industry. There's a ton of stuff in the expo that I recommend that you look at. Fast Pinball is here, Multimorphic is here, Marco, Pinball Life are all here. But the point is that, you know, leverage them as much as possible. They're catering to either restorers or people or people that want to do production machines. A few of them do custom stuff. But
have you worked with either the P-Rock or Fast?
I use P-Rock's power driver.
Okay, I was wondering if you...
Yeah, so okay. So I buy that sort of off the shelf from them. But I interface with the Arduino, so the Arduino talks to the power driver. Very simple. They have a system that's way more complex than that, where they, you know, they have their own
PC
script. Yeah, exactly. And also the mission platform, whatever.
What's the name of your emulator that you use?
For the virtual stuff, there's a program called Visual Pinball. There's also one called Future Pinball. Visual Pinball is a little bit easier to get into. but it's also a free download, and in the game, the tables are free to download as well. So the blog I have, I try to keep it as organized as possible, even though my posts are sort of all over the place. I try to keep them tagged so that if you want to search a specific thing.
This isn't Space 8, was it?
No, this isn't Space 8, but the I have two websites. One is this How to Build a Pinball Machine, which is sort of in the format of a book, in the sense that if you go back to it as a resource, if you wanted information about, so this post is about hooking up the multimorphic power driver. I have a post here on how to build the head and the cabinets. There's a post here about how to program Arduino to do a switch matrix. And I've got code underneath, all the code posted here. So this is sort of more of the reference. Then I also have if you go to the Space 8 website, which is sort of my main. There will be links on the Space 8 website, and it's on the card, the promo cards I have, but it's www.space-8eight.com. The front page of that is basically the pinball page, even though it has a bunch of other technical projects I've worked on, but the front page is the pinball page. And what you'll see, if you go, there'll be a link to a downloads page, and that download page has, I'm not online, so I'm not able to get to it, but the downloads page has templates for all the play fields that I've done, so it's, I mean, you could copy them directly if you wanted to, but the idea is more that you could use it as a template to create your own game. And you might say, here's what a cutout for a thumper looks like, and I'll just take it and I'll move it around or do whatever. So a lot of CAD drawings, a lot of code. I use Inkscape a lot for drawing, doing the illustrations, and so I have some Inkscape files there as well.
As far as the Arduino, do you expect people to have a little bit of an understanding, or if they follow in here step by step, they should be able to feel a little bit more?
I have all the code that I use on my machines, I've uploaded, and not only the whole code, but also test code and templates for the Arduino. So for instance, if you want code on just the switch matrix, you could program the Arduino to just do the switch matrix, or to just do the pin score display, or just do the multimorphic driver. And then Arduino itself has a lot of resources on their website to get you started. So that's a free download. You can buy them at Radio Shack, or my favorite is Adafruit. It's a great resource for that.
You said you have the CAD drawings. You have your own CAD app. That can definitely work.
Yeah, so I do have my own CAD app, but I do recommend this program called Inkscape, which it technically is sort of like, it's like Illustrator. It's, I would say it's as good as Illustrator, if not better, but it's also free, so it's a free download. But Inkscape actually allows you to import DXFs and export DXFs. So if you do have a CAD program, you can do your design work in Inkscape and then export it to a DXF program. A lot of laser cutters and CNC routers, they actually take Inkscape files directly. That's just sort of been the standard. On top of that, if you do your artwork in Inkscape as well, then you're guaranteed that your art is going to line up with your CAD. So it's, if you don't have a CAD program, then that's okay.
One last question. I noticed you had cards for 2 and 3. Did you have cards for number 1?
I do, yeah. They're out there.
Were they
on
the machine?
I just brought them out today, but they should be out there.
On the machines. There was actually a fourth random card that I was standing around that somebody got.
There is a fourth one, which the game's not here, but it does It was in the presentation, but the game is sort of like about 6 months out.
That's the tattoo.
The tattoo mystique. And I know, yeah, I know we kind of overran our time, but if anybody, at any time, I'll be here the whole show. If anybody has any questions, I'm all about trying to be as open as possible about anything, techniques, materials, resources.
Do you have a booth that's in there, or you just be, or just be around?
I'll just be around, but I'll especially be trying to maintain those machines, so my machines are in the hallway.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.